From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to National Journal, and Oren Durrell, Foreign Affairs Reporter for USA Today. And here are the issues. President Obama welcomed leaders of the Gulf Cooperation Council to Camp David to reassure them about U.S. commitments to their security. But only two of six heads of state attended, and Obama stopped short of offering the formal defense pact some GCC countries had sought to counterbalance an impending nuclear agreement with Iran. There were conflicting reports from South Korea over whether North Korean leader Kim Jong-un had ordered the execution of his defense minister in a particularly gruesome manner. The Vatican announced that it has reached agreement with the Palestinians on an accord extending formal recognition to a Palestinian state. At the same time, a narrow new right-wing Israeli government took office, diminishing already slim prospects for a negotiated two-state solution. And finally, in the United States, potential Republican presidential nominee Jeb Bush stumbled in his answers to questions about whether he would have authorized the 2003 invasion of Iraq, a key foreign policy legacy of his brother, President George W. Bush. Tom, let's start with the GCC summit. King Salman of Saudi Arabia did not attend. The leaders of Bahrain, Oman, and the UAE also stayed home. So only the emirs of Kuwait and Qatar attended. Now, the leaders of Oman and the UAE are in poor health, but Salman had said he was going to come, and this summit was mostly about symbolism. So what did the fact that only two of the six leaders show mean about the symbolism of this summit?
Well, I think, Barbara, that it shows what we already knew, which is Gulf state leaders are very concerned about President Obama's determination to get, if he can, get a nuclear deal with Iran. The Gulf state leaders view Iran as the most mortal threat they have to their existence, and they're very nervous about it. Now, the symbolism that the King of Saudi Arabia, who is the major player here, sending a deputy crown prince.
And a crown prince,
right. It's pretty heavy hitters, but it was not the king who as recently as 3 days before the conference had said he would definitely be there, and then suddenly he wasn't. It just shows that the Gulf state leaders and some other Arab nations are very, very nervous about this. So the symbolism is not good. It's yet another indication that some longstanding allies in the Arab world are nervous about the Obama administration's leadership. And I think the main purpose of the summit was to reassure them. And like most situations like this, the wording, the diplomatic language at the end of the conference at Camp David, the president's private retreat in the mountains of Maryland, seemed to suggest all was well, but everybody knows that's not the case. The president spent a lot of time reassuring his other colleagues that, in effect, we're not going to sell them out to get a deal with Iran. On the other hand, the president said he was absolutely determined to do it. So I think it was a wash at best, and maybe a small net minus for the president, but it was something he had to do.
Yeah, I mean, he did say that, you know, protecting the Persian Gulf region is a, quote, fundamental tenet of U.S. foreign policy that goes back 70 years. But he had a terrible slip in his, he had a private meeting at the White House with the Crown Prince and the Deputy Crown Prince. And he talked about 70 years previously when FDR met with King Faisal. Of course, it was King Abdulaziz, the founder of Saudi Arabia. King Faisal came later. So, you know, Obama didn't even get his history right. The other thing that struck me was that in his comments at Camp David, you know, they talked about increasing cooperation on the military front, more military exercises, more cooperation on cyber crime, on terrorism, and so on. But then he also said that the purpose of security cooperation is not to perpetuate any long-term confrontation with Iran or even to marginalize Iran. And that, I think, puts him in direct confrontation with the GCC because they want to marginalize Iran, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. They're nervous as can be about Iran. And so this has not been the smoothest diplomatic engagement I've seen out of the Obama White House. I mean, that language is problematic for a lot of countries that go well beyond the Arab world.
Yeah. Oren, we're talking obviously about the statements, the deliverables that came out of Camp David. There wasn't much, was there? There was an agreement to have another summit next year and talk about more military exercises, making it easier for the Gulf states to buy weapons. But was it what they hoped to achieve when they came to Washington?
I would say no. The Gulf Arab monarchies came to Washington wanting a firm commitment, not just a commitment, but an actual defense treaty with the United States.
Well, some of them did, UAE, for example.
Some of them, similar to what the United States has with Japan or with NATO, with European countries and NATO. They did not get that. They also wanted not only more weapons, but they wanted the most advanced American weapons. It doesn't seem like they got that either. There are people in Congress who are concerned about maintaining Israel's qualitative military edge, and they don't want to make the Gulf Arab nations have more advanced weapons than Israel. So the Gulf countries did not get everything they wanted, but I think they had an opportunity to express their concerns about the Iranian nuclear deal.
Mm-hmm. And also, of course, Tom, the administration had an opportunity to explain the Iranian nuclear deal in a little bit more detail. I assume that they got the latest briefing on what actually is going to be in this long-term agreement.
Well, they did, and that was another main function of this summit, to try to reassure the Gulf state leaders that they were not being sold out for a deal, and that the deal, while President Obama is really committed to one if he can get it by June 30th, has safeguards. The Obama administration believes there are safeguards that will protect both Israel and nervous Gulf allies in the Arab world, and we will have to see about that. Whether they are reassured remains to be seen. I suspect that in the days ahead, we're going to be seeing some nervous, unidentified Arab officials talking about how concerned they are still. Mm-hmm. Concern, whatever.
Yeah. Time now for a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Barbara Slavin with Oren Durrell and Tom DeFrank, and we were talking about the GCC summit. Just one last point on this before we move on, Oren. I was in some meetings off record with some of the Arab leaders who actually were looking to the United States to somehow mediate between them and Iran, which I thought was extraordinary. I mean, if you look at the region now, there are all these proxy conflicts going on in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq. And to me, it seems very strange that the Saudis and the Iranians aren't able, for example, to talk to each other without using the United States, which has no diplomatic relations with Iran, as an intermediary.
Yeah, that is kind of remarkable. One thing I think that is worth mentioning, kind of going back to the whole point of the summit and some of the kind of overarching concerns related to it, is that there are Saudi leaders and others in the Gulf who have said that this deal with Iran, which basically limits Iran's nuclear program for, up to 10 to 15 years, and then expires, parts of it expire at that point, that basically how long it takes to build a domestic nuclear program. And the Saudis have come out and said, leading up to the summit, that if Iran gets the capacity to continue to enrich uranium, that they're going to get that capacity too. And there's a very large worry that the deal that is aimed at controlling the nuclear program in Iran and staunching proliferation in the Gulf will actually end up doing the opposite, that it will allow the Iranian nuclear program to continue and lead to proliferation in the Gulf. So this summit is these issues, this conflict between Iran and the Saudis and the Shiite Iran and the Sunnis and Sunni Arabs in the Gulf. It's sort of coming to a head, and I think what you encountered was concern that this thing could get worse,
Yeah, it may indeed. And on the proliferation aspect, of course, the countries of the GCC, to get these kinds of nuclear programs, I mean, Iran has been working on its nuclear program off and on since the days of the Shah, so it takes a long time to build infrastructure and expertise, and countries like Saudi Arabia really don't have that. The UAE is just starting down that path. So sometimes I think there's a little bit more rhetoric than reality in their threats. The other thing is that ultimately they do depend on the United States to guarantee them against external threats, as President Obama said. And so that gives the U.S. some leverage in terms of what these countries can do on the nuclear front. But let's move on to another country that actually has nuclear weapons and that has been showing some really strange behavior lately, Tom. Not that it hasn't always, but that's North Korea. This was something that came out at me that's just incredible. According to the South Korean spy agency, since Kim Jong-un took power in 2011, 72 senior military and party officials in North Korea have been purged, have been executed. And of course, there were conflicting reports about whether the latest one to go was a guy named General Hyun Yong-chol, who was the defense minister, and according to some reports, Tom, was executed with anti-aircraft weapons, which really seems like the definition of overkill. What do we know about this, and what can you make of this 30-year-old Kim Jong-un, who is, in charge?
Well, it suggests to me, Barbara, that he's trying to be in charge, and he's desperate and paranoid about threats to his authority, real and imagined. Certainly paranoid. I think it was about, 18 months or 2 years ago that he had his uncle, senior Army general, executed. And I have no doubt that there is a huge purge underway. But the whole notion of being executed with an anti-aircraft missile is a little far-fetched, even for the North Koreans. I tell you, if you can't sleep some night and want to have some real fun, go to the North Korean official website, and they use things like Yellow Dog and imperialist Nazis, and the rhetoric on this website is not to be believed. It's so juvenile and childish and amateurish. But I suspect we're going to find that this defense minister was in fact executed, and we'll find that out in a few days or so. But that's the bottom line. This kid is struggling to maintain his authority, to establish his authority, and he's willing to do whatever he has to do to purge enemy people he believes are his enemy. And the bottom line there is it's clearly another example of yet more instability in a country that
has 10 nuclear weapons.
Right, precisely.
Yeah, apparently the crime of this general, Oren, was that he fell asleep during a lecture that Kim Jong-un was giving. And, I remember his father, Kim Jong-il, was also a little strange, but he had a policy of what he called military first. And he did everything he could to safeguard the military and to nurture his generals. So is this wise in the long term? If people keep getting executed for minor offenses, that would seem to maybe be cause for a coup at some point.
It could. We're looking at a leader who, first of all, canceled a trip to Moscow also in the past few weeks. And then we find out about this general being executed. So he seems to be uneasy about even leaving his country. He's so insecure. We're talking about a leader whose regime hacked Sony for a juvenile movie about his assassination and threatened acts of terror at American movie theaters over the showing of a film. So we're not talking about someone who's particularly secure in his leadership. But at the same time, if you look at the people who are being executed, the pattern that I see is a lot of very senior and much older leaders who are undoubtedly being replaced by younger people that probably he can rely on, or he feels that he can rely on. So I think that the policy that he has is Kim Jong-un first, and then maybe military first, but that his first priority is to keep himself safe. And whether that leads to a coup or not, I don't know.
Tom, in Asian culture, there's supposed to be a reverence for people who are older. So, this is shocking on so many levels. But, are there contingency plans? What happens? There have been a lot of alarming reports that North Korea is increasing its nuclear arsenal. You know, does China have a plan B? Does South Korea have a plan B? Does the U.S. have a plan B in case that place implodes?
Well, I think the military, the U.S. military, has a plan B. They've been there since the end of the Korean War or the Korean armistice. The military has a contingency plan, but I don't know what you do, how you deal with the reality of you've got a kind of a unstable leader here. It's going to be tricky. And the other thing that's disturbing to a lot of U.S. officials is the Chinese are the closest thing to a mentor to the North Koreans. And in the past, the Chinese have been able to establish some persuasive powers here. You get a feeling that this President Kim is not listening to anybody, including the Chinese, which is worrisome.
I want to get to the Palestinian issue, but Tom, I want to go first actually to Jeb Bush and U.S. domestic politics, which have a link to foreign affairs. Last few days, we've seen some extraordinary comments by Jeb Bush. He's been asked what he would have done in 2003 with Iraq, and he said to an interviewer from Fox News that he would have invaded. Then he said that his response was misinterpreted. Then he said it was hypothetical and he couldn't say. And then finally he said, well, if we knew then what we know now, no, I wouldn't have. How does all of this reflect on Jeb Bush and reflect on his viability as a candidate for the Republican nomination, should he choose to run?
Poorly, very poorly. What it shows at best is that Jeb Bush is a little rusty after having not run a campaign for 14 years. The political world has turned upside down in the last 14 years, and he didn't have a good week. There's no doubt about it, Barbara, but it also shows that he was not prepared to deal with something that he should have been prepared for from day one, which is how do you handle the business with his brother, former President George W. Bush. I mean, I often say the Bush name is an asset to Jeb Bush, but it's also a big liability.
Sure.
And that is the problem, and it seems like he wasn't ready to deal with this. I mean, he had a terrible 4 or 5 days. On the other hand, it's about 560 days until the next election. I think the real problem for this is, as you suggest, Barbara, in the Republican primary process, there are a lot of Republicans who don't think Jeb is, he's not their first choice. He's too establishment. He's too moderate of a conservative. He's another Bush. And this just gives grist or fuel to the fire to those Republicans who think he's a yesterday's person, and it's even worse that his name is Bush. So he hasn't performed well, and that's going to hurt him in the primaries, unless he starts winning somewhere 6 months from now.
All right. Time now for another break. We'll be right back with Issues in the News.
Here's a quick quiz. What do the letters LTATOMLAW stand for? We know the answer, right? Listen to Akwae Thompson on Nightline Africa Weekends. Add to that 16 and 18 UTC on VOA, and we have a perfect score. That was easy.
Welcome back. I'm Barbara Slavin with Oren Durrell and Tom DeFrank. Oren, yeah, as Tom said, this is the one question that you would think Jeb Bush would have prepared for. What accounts for the fact that he, you know, sort of meandered back and forth between various answers?
Well, one of the things that I saw was that he said that he misunderstood the question and that his initial response was that he thought the question was based on what they knew then and not based on what they know now. The question was about what they, you know, considering what you know now, would you?
Yeah, but
would
the
you
question was, and I'm quoting, knowing
right.
what we know now,
right.
which
and,
revolves
and he said,
the invasion.
And he said later that he misinterpreted the question. He was answering a different question.
I think there's another point, Barbara, and that is it's a problem for Jeb Bush in the larger context of his brother. He's been saying to off-the-record fundraising breakfasts and lunches, I am my own man. My name is Bush, but I'm different from, I love my father, I love my brother, but I'm Jeb. I'm not them, and my policies are very different from them. And you square that with what he's said in the recent couple of weeks, which is, my brother is my best advisor on Middle East policy. And so he has a tightrope to walk. He has to figure out a way to distance himself from his brother, who left office as a very unpopular president, and he's not doing that very well either. So it's one of those horrible, no good, not very nice, unfortunate weeks for Jeb Bush. The only good thing for Jeb Bush is the election is 18 months away, and the first primary balloting is 6 months away. So he has time to recover. It's always good for a politician if you're just doing really poorly is to get it out of the way early. The key is, can he not repeat these kind of things, or is this an example of a systemic problem? We'll know in the next few months.
I think one of the things that this points out in the broader picture is that the Republicans still don't have a front runner, and the Democrats obviously do in Hillary Clinton. And every time one of these, you know, gaffes or mistakes happen on the Republican side, it sort of derails another campaign, or slightly derails another campaign.
Yeah, and obviously Hillary, you know, is in a better position since she, you know, at this point at least, doesn't have to defend. Well, we'll see. She will have to defend, won't she? Yeah. Obama's policies, at least on the issues where she was involved when she was Secretary of State. Of course, she has not given a press conference for a while. So Jeb Bush has been out there, and he was confronted by a student who said, well, your brother created the group that calls itself the Islamic State by invading Iraq. And he didn't have a good answer for that either. So I think he's going to need to bone up. So we will now switch to our final topic, and that is the Palestinian issue and Israel, or a couple of developments in recent days. The Vatican made more formal its recognition of Palestine. It's apparently reached a fairly detailed agreement on how it will recognize the Palestinian state. And this puts the Vatican in the company now of a number of other countries. I think there's something like 130 countries that technically recognize Palestine. What does this do for Israel and for its position in the international community?
First of all, what the Vatican did was it said that it's going to recognize the state of Palestine, and the Vatican has a very big, actually has a major role in the peace negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians, because it represents the largest constituency of Christians, and therefore has a say on the disposition of Jerusalem, which mm-hmm. both sides, both the Palestinians and Israelis, claim as their capital. And it's a multi-religious, multi-denominational city, and the religious authorities have a say, and the Vatican's therefore have a very large say. So it's actually a very important player with regards to that very important mm-hmm. issue. Internationally, this sort of adds to, I think it was Sweden.
Actually, it's 135 UN yeah. members now recognize the Palestinian state. 160 UN members recognize Israel. So they're only 35 behind.
Right.
Behind.
So it creates sort of like, the Palestinians are saying that this creates a momentum and they're behind them becoming a state and increasing pressure on Israel. And they're hoping to increase pressure on Israel through all these international organizations and through divestment and getting people to stop, maybe, you know, even imposing, to the point of imposing sanctions on Israel or not doing business with Israel, which Israel has been exposed to some of that all along. Mm-hmm. The Israelis say it's not going to have any impact because at the end of the day, they have to talk to the Israelis mm-hmm. in order to have a state and in order to have their independence and in order to have the all the things that there's a lot of interconnectedness between Israel and the territories. So the Israelis are saying, as a practical matter, this has very little impact. You know, they're saying you still have to talk to us. And this is actually sort of going in the opposite direction from negotiations, which mm-hmm. is what they say right. needs to happen.
Of course, now with this narrow right-wing government taking power with only 61 seats in the Knesset and very much a hawkish pro-settlement government, it doesn't look likely that there are going to be any Israeli-Palestinian talks anytime soon, which also probably fuels this international effort, yeah?
Well, that's sort of the thing, is that the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, especially under the Netanyahu government, haven't been going anywhere. Yeah. And the Kerry Obama initiative to bring them about failed. So we'll see. There'll be some more of this happening for years to come, I think.
Yeah. That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Oren Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is senior VOA congressional correspondent Cindy Sain. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Congressman James Clyburn, a Democrat from the state of South Carolina. And we're coming to you from his office on Capitol Hill. Elected in 1993, Congressman Clyburn rose quickly through the leadership ranks of the Democratic Party. He is currently the number three Democrat in the House of Representatives. He is the leadership liaison to the powerful Appropriations Committee, one of the Democratic Caucus's primary liaisons to the White House, and chair of the recently formed House Democrats Democratic Outreach and Engagement Task Force. With the opposition Republican Party in control of both houses of Congress, we'll talk with Congressman Clyburn about a range of critical U.S. domestic and foreign policy issues facing the U.S. Congress. Congressman Clyburn, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
I'm delighted to welcome my colleague Cindy Sain as well.
Thank you.
Well, Congressman, first off, I'd like to ask you about your chairmanship of this House Democrats Democratic Outreach and Engagement Task Force. Talk about that. What's the purpose?
Well, thank you so much for having me. That outreach task force is just what it says, is outreach and engagement. We have found in recent elections that our ability to connect with our base voters has been lacking. We had less than a stellar turnout in the off-the-year elections, and that's two times running. And so part of this task force's responsibility is to find ways to connect with our voters when there's not a presidential election going on. We don't have a big problem with our base voters when the presidential is taking place. But there's a tremendous fall off in the non-presidential years that we call off-year elections. And what we're trying to do now is trying to see if there's a way for us to lessen that fall off and how to do it. So we call it outreach and engagement because that's what we're trying to do, reach out to our base voters, engage them in whatever it is they may want to be engaged, and hopefully have that turn out as a successful election for these off years.
And perhaps to bring the Democrats back into the leadership.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking
sure.
of which, of course, now that the Republicans are in charge of both the Senate and the House of Representatives, how's that working out for you?
Well, not good. Well, you know, we think the next time around, I feel very good about our ability to get the Senate back. Less optimistic about getting the House back the next time. But we think we'll make, if this task force does what it's supposed to do, what we want to do, I think we'll start the road back to the majority and we'll get there very soon.
Well, let me turn to my colleague Cindy for a question.
Yes, sure. Congressman Clyburn, it would seem that we have seen a wave of cases over the past year of what appears to be the excessive use of force by some law enforcement officers, particularly with African Americans and people of color. Do you think that this is an issue that has always been around and that prominent cases, such as the one of the shooting of an unarmed teenager in Ferguson and the recent case of a man who died in police custody in Baltimore, do you think that that's just raising people's awareness now that they're out and people are actually recording encounters with their iPhones?
Absolutely. Sure, this has been an issue for a long time. And I think that what has caused the problem to seem to manifest itself is the fact that people are now seeing it. We've heard it for a long time. It's been there. I grew up in the South. I grew up knowing what it's like to go into a department store and have a police officer follow you around the department store. I know what it's like to be profiled. And so for people to think that this is something new, the only thing that's new is now people are using their mobile phones to record some of this. I remember several years ago, the incident was in Rodney King out in California. Rodney King became a sensational issue simply because people saw it. But these kinds of complaints have been made in California for a long time. And so in Charleston, that was my congressional district, Walter Scott, people saw it. And we even saw the police officer seeming to plant evidence. All of that's on the screen. Now, we've been hearing that forever, that police officers, many of them, carry around an extra weapon of sorts just for that kind of purpose. I've been hearing that for as long as I can remember. So this isn't anything new. Just seeing it is now believing.
Right. What role, if any, do you think Congress can play in addressing some of the root causes of tension between law enforcement officers and people of color, or just people in general in some of these poorer urban communities?
Well, there are many things Congress could do. The first thing we need to do, in my opinion, is to have a very strong anti-profiling law. The second thing, I think, is we need to reverse in this, I call it militarizing police forces. Police forces ought to be community police people. They ought not be soldiers, combat soldiers. And this whole thing of dressing out in combat gear and all of that kind of stuff, that's crazy stuff. And I think it leads to people doing things they would not ordinarily do in trying to carry out the law. A third thing I think we could do is make sure that laws that have been passed recently get revisited over mandatory minimums. I think that has had a tremendous adverse impact on these communities. And laws governing child or alimony and that sort of stuff, that stuff leads to a bunch of arrests. And how do you pay alimony if you're in jail? And then the person then becomes almost ineligible for a lot of jobs once the record is put there. So we need to take a look at all of this. You know, I saw a number the other day that shocks me. The number seems to say that we are 5% in the United States of America. We are 5% of the world's population, but we have 25% of the incarcerations. Something's wrong with that.
Well, Congressman Clyburn, you know, we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of the signing of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Top Senate Republicans John Cornyn and Chuck Grassley have recently rejected calls for voting rights fixes, saying that more minorities are voting and that the Voting Rights Act is no longer applicable because in the last 50 years there has been great progress. Do you share that feeling, or do you think Congress should repair the Voting Rights Act formula that was struck down by the Supreme Court in 2013?
Sure, Congress should repair that. You know, this whole notion that all of a sudden centuries of bad behavior, centuries of laws that have been used to neutralize voting all of a sudden goes away because you have had a half century of laws trying to make those corrections. The fact of the matter is, and we've seen it, legislatures all over this country are now passing laws that bring back what I call a modern day application of poll taxes and other kinds of devices that were used to nullify votes. I mean, when you talk about voter ID, that's a term that we've put out here to camouflage other kinds of activities. For instance, I've never voted in my life when I didn't ID myself. So the question is not whether or not we have voter ID. The question is, what are you requiring for that ID? Why is it okay for the ID to be a hunter's license, but it's not okay for it to be a student activity card? These are the kinds of things that are being used. All of a sudden now, we see redistricting being done, and though the law says you shouldn't, they're stacking African Americans all into one district. That's not new. At the turn of the last century, in the 1890s, in South Carolina, congressional redistricting was done after the 1890 census, and in that redistricting, they were all over the state, didn't have one man, one vote, and they just lumped all of the black communities into one congressional district, way out of whack, but again, one man, one vote, and it stayed that way for 95 years. then you pass laws that says you got to be able to, so-called literacy tests. And the person administering the literacy test wouldn't recognize the right answer when they heard it. So these kinds of things you've had going on for a long time. And we're bringing that back with a modern application of those same things.
Well, in relation to that topic, Congressman, of course, this is this issue of gerrymandering, this manipulation of district boundaries to gain partisan advantage. Some top Democratic attorneys are arguing before state and federal courts that district maps, as you said, have been drawn in a handful of states that violated the Voting Rights Act by improperly packing black voters into a small number of districts, limiting their influence. Is there anything wrong with the practice, per se, and do you think it should the task of drawing up district lines be taken out of the hands of politicians and given to perhaps special commissions?
I don't think so. I think the politicians can be made to do the right things. They were doing the right thing with the proper application of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. When they got this new interpretation of the Voting Rights Act is when they start going back to stacking people. They weren't stacking people before. You look at it, the Justice Department says, wait a minute, this is too much of a deviation. And you had to go back and redo the cases. Now, all of a sudden, that's what the form is all about. You've got Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, which renders Section 5 kind of impotent. And so that's what's happened here. Sure, it ought to stay, I think, in the hands of the legislative bodies, but the guidelines should be drawn up and followed so that they won't have stacking, which I call bleaching. Because you're putting all these black people in one district, or to bleach out all the districts around it. So it's more bleaching than stacking.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Congressman James Clyburn, a Democrat from the state of South Carolina. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA congressional correspondent Cindy Sain. And this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. You can send feedback via email as well to PCUSA@voanews.com. Either way, tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan from the Western Cape, Amarencia August.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
And now a question from Cindy.
Congressman, as I'm sure you're aware, there's a lot of discussion right now on the National Security Agency's controversial surveillance program, program of collecting the phone data of millions of Americans. And the author of the Patriot Act, passed to help U.S. intelligence agencies gather the information they need after the September 11th attacks, James Sensenbrenner, wants to make some changes to the Patriot Act under a bill called the USA Freedom Act. What is your view on this whole debate on surveillance and the trade-off between privacy rights and national security?
Well, I think Sensenbrenner is right to revisit that, and I like his attitude about that. As you said, he was the original author of the Patriot Act, which I was against when it was passed, still am against, because I think it goes too far with the invasion of privacy. And now we have a court decision saying that it goes too far. And so I'm glad to see that he is revisiting that. But he's that kind of guy. He was also the author of the last Voting Rights Act renewal and was very upset when the Supreme Court disregarded the hard work he put into that. And he has now come forth with legislation to correct that. So he's staying true to form in addressing that issue. And I support him.
Congressman Clyburn, let's turn to foreign policy for a moment and talk about fast-track authority, which was being discussed in the Senate last week. In an unusual turn of partisan forces, as you know, President Obama is drawing support mostly from Republicans, in pushing for trade promotion authority. And of course, he's facing fierce opposition from many lawmakers in the Democratic Party. Are you one of the opponents of trade promotion authority, or do you stand with the president in favor of it?
Neither. I have not seen the legislation, and therefore, I've made it very clear to everybody that I will not express support or opposition to anything blindly. And so when my staff and I have gone through this legislation to our satisfaction, I'll then make up my mind as to whether or not I'll be for it or against it.
Congressman Clyburn, just hypothetically, though, giving the president the ability to, you know, negotiate trade deals without too many amendments from the Congress, does that sit well with you, or?
Well, there's one thing that to say without too many amendments. It's something else to say without no amendments. And that's what the issue here is. Now, you don't have to do amendments if you have all of the concerns addressed in the primary legislation. And I have concerns about whether workers' rights will be protected. I have concerns about the environment. I voted the last time for the Panama Treaty and the Korea Treaty, and I voted against Colombia because I had real concerns about the way workers, labor union officials were being treated in Colombia. So I've been on both sides of these issues. I was against NAFTA, but I was for the ag bill. I was for that. So I've been on both sides of these issues. It all based upon who are you doing your trade with, what kind of records these people have in the countries, do they respect environmental issues, do they respect working men and women? All of that factors in to whether or not I'm for or against a particular piece of trade bill.
Well, that leads us to your view on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's the 12-nation
sure.
trade pact that, according to the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, it's a 21st century trade agreement that would boost U.S. economic growth, support American jobs, and grow Made in America exports to some of the most dynamic and fast-growing countries in the world. And of course, it's the cornerstone of the Obama administration's economic policy in the Asia Pacific. I would probably argue that aside from a landmark nuclear deal, should that come to fruition, bringing the TPP, as it's called, to fruition is very high on President Obama's foreign policy agenda. And they're saying that, you know, trade promotion authority is seen as essential for that. What is your position, you know, regarding this 12-nation trade pact, which has the strong backing of America's businesses, but it, of course, does have fierce opposition at this moment by labor groups and environmentalists?
Well, my position is, as I just stated, you know, you're talking about 12 nations here. Last time we addressed this, it was three, Colombia, Panama, and Korea. My memory serves, NAFTA was Canada, Mexico, and the United States. Lumping 12 developing countries into one bill. And I think developing countries have got to be cut some slack on certain things. However, from what I've heard about the treatment of workers in Vietnam, it gives me great pause. And so my question is, are we going to have sufficient protections for these workers? Or are we going to allow our markets to open up to sweatshops? That, to me, is a real problem. And so I've looked at Sandy Levin's alternative legislation. I've discussed that with President Obama, as well as various labor leaders. And I'm waiting to see how much, if any, Sandy Levin's alternative will be included in these issues. You may recall that the last time we addressed fast track, we did not give President Clinton fast track. We drew up something called the May 10th agreements, and they were tacked on to the legislation. And that did what a lot of us wanted done in order to protect people. So all of these things can still happen with this legislation. So I'm open to do, as Nancy Pelosi has said many times, to finding a pathway to yes. We have not found it yet.
Congressman Clyburn, this week President Obama hosted Gulf countries to allay their fears about a prospective nuclear deal with Tehran that appears to be emerging. Are you in favor of the deal and the right of Congress to review it?
Well, yes, I think so. It's one thing to review, it's something else to veto. I don't think that Congress ought to have any right to circumvent the president. Now, this foolishness that's been going on up here is just that foolishness. And we have to be very, very careful. And for people not to see, look, I'm old enough to have seen and to have paid close attention to many presidents, all the way back to Truman. I first got interested in politics when Truman ran against Dewey back in 1948. And I've been following closely every president since. And so I will say to my friends, be very, very careful how you treat this president, because the turnabout is fair play.
Exactly.
And I think that this president has not been treated with the dignity and respect that he should be treated with, especially when it comes to his dealings with foreign countries. And that, to me, is a big problem here. So I support this country speaking with one voice when we get beyond the water's edge. And that is not taking place now. So these shenanigans that took place here.
The letter that a number of Republicans.
The letter that they wrote, the invitation to Netanyahu to address and dress down the President of the United States, to me, went beyond the pale.
A quick follow-up, Congressman Clyburn. Regarding the allies in the region, as you know, they're very skittish, the Sunni Gulf countries, about a prospective deal. What do you think is the best way to assuage them if a deal is in fact consummated, such that it won't be a green light for Iran to continue to support terrorism in the region, whether it's Hezbollah or Hamas or via other proxies? That is really their underlying concern.
Well, sure, suppose we do nothing. How does that address the underlying concern? The best way to address their concerns is for us to do a deal and to have benchmarks that can in fact be measured and have agreements that can be determined whether or not they have been violated. Right now, what do we have? And how does that protect the people in the region?
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays, or subscribe to the Encounter podcast. Just go to our homepage at voanews.com and click on Podcasts. Also, we love to hear from you. Send an email to encounter@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA and follow us on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America. Now a question from Cindy.
Yes, Congressman, as part of the National Defense Authorization Act, there's been a part added to that which would put into debate the question of allowing the so-called DREAMers, young immigrants who have been granted legal status by President Obama, to enlist and serve in the U.S. military. Where do you stand on this issue of the DREAMers serving in the U.S. military?
I'm standing with it. I do believe, my Lord, really not a dream. There are a lot of people who have served in the military without full citizenship. If my memory serves, I believe that the first person that lost his life in Iraq may have been fighting on behalf of this country without full citizenship. I'm not 100% sure about that, but I think I'm right. And so I used to run a migrant and seasonal farm worker program down in South Carolina, and I know full well that a lot of young people traveling through this country as migrant and farm workers in agricultural areas were with their parents. And I know those parents gave birth to children there. Those children became citizens. Parents didn't. A lot of those children went off to fight in the military because they are really citizens. And I think there's something wrong with saying to those parents, you're not subject to being sent back home, breaking up families without any regards to valuing families. So I think that we have a broken immigration system. It should be fixed. And I am a little bit leery about separating dreamers from people and creating nightmares in doing so.
Before we close, Congressman Clyburn, what about the new policy vis-a-vis Cuba, U.S. opening up to Cuba? How do you view this normalization of relations? And what about lifting the embargo, which, of course, only Congress can do?
I will vote to lift it. I support opening up the relationship between us and Cuba. I have been to Cuba. I have been a longtime advocate for getting rid of what I consider to be an inane policy regarding Cuba.
And before we close, Congressman Clyburn, do you have anything you'd like to talk to our audience about, any particular issue that you'd like to address?
I don't know that I have anything particular. You know, we've covered a wide array of issues here, and all of them are important to me. I don't single out any one issue that's more important than others, except maybe maintaining stability in families and communities. I do believe that it's time for our world, most especially this country, to begin to focus attention on communities of need. I think that we have a bad problem with citing overall numbers in order to determine whether or not we have been successful. And by that I mean the economy is coming back, jobs are being created. The question then becomes, who's getting those jobs? And in what communities are these jobs being created? This rising income, whose income is it? The inequality in this country, I think, is approaching catastrophic consequences. And there's a lot of inequality in the world as well.
Any thoughts about the 2016 presidential race and the Democratic contenders, of which we know Hillary Clinton, of course, is one?
Well, sure. And she's by far the leading candidate. But I would say she's not the only candidate. And I always say in this business, and when they say, oh, you have to worry about your opposition, that's, well, if my opposition is breathing, I worry about them. And I really believe that Hillary Clinton, as far out ahead of the pack that she is, I think that we'll have a competitive primary on the Democratic side. It's kind of funny. The last poll I saw had Jeb Bush somewhere around 4%. But these same people are saying that he is probably the leading contender in spite of what the numbers say. So if that's true on the negative side, why is it not true on the positive side?
Congressman James Clyburn is a Democrat from the state of South Carolina. He is the number 3 Democrat in the leadership in the Congress. Well, Congressman Clyburn, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Appreciate your insights. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Gary Jaffe. And joining me on the program was VOA congressional correspondent Cindy Sain. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.